This is the Dreamers Podcast, where dreamers share their stories to inspire you. Now, join host Joe Pardo as he interviews a dreamer who's living their dreams.
Let's try that. Test 1, 2. Okay, that's better. All right. Hey, Dreamers, I'm Joe Pardo, and today I'm talking with Ryan Levesque, who is making his dreams come true by becoming a marketing expert and a business coach, and recently a author. So congratulations on that, Ryan. Glad to have you on the show.
I'm really super excited to be here, my man, and thanks so much for your kind words.
Well, it's very exciting to have you have such a successful person that's so far ahead of the, you know, in their game that they're trying to accomplish. So why don't you start by giving some background about yourself?
Sure. So, I mean, we could start in a couple of different places. So the high level is, so I grew up very blue collar, working class family. I was the first in my family to go to college. And sort of a really big deal to do that. And not only went to college, but was fortunate enough to get into an Ivy League school and studied neuroscience and East Asian studies at Brown University. In university, I had no idea what I wanted to do. I thought I was going to become a doctor. I had to disappoint my parents and tell them one day that their son wasn't going to become Dr. Levesque. And that was a bit of a shock to them. And so after graduation, I really didn't know what I wanted to do. I was really interested in a couple different things. I was really interested in East Asian studies and Chinese, and I studied and spoke Chinese. But I was also interested in business. And as a kid, I'd invested in the stock market. I thought, well, maybe it would be cool to work on Wall Street. So worked on Wall Street after graduation, realized that wasn't what I wanted to do with the rest of my life. Had this burning passion to go to China, go to Asia, and basically tackle the wild, wild west of Chinese business. And had an opportunity to do that. My wife and I moved to China, spent about 5 years overseas, and was working for the financial services company AIG, and was responsible for a major expansion project in China, where I was opening up sales offices around the country. I was leading a big team and living out of hotels and tethered to the BlackBerry. And sort of in my mid-20s, I had this midlife crisis, and I said, wait, I've seen what these guys who our lifers look like. I've seen what these guys, when they're in their 50s and 60s and they get the gold watch and they, you know, ride off into the sunset. And I said, I don't want to be one of those guys. I have more that I want to do, more that I want to contribute than just to go down that path. But what do I want to do? And so that just led me down this kind of deep journey around what I wanted to do with my life, and eventually arrived at the idea of building an online business. This was in 2007, 2008. And I can tell the rest of the story, but long story short, after some struggle and a lot of trial and error, arrived at where we are today, which is we have an online business. We've got a team of about, around 25 people now. We're spread mostly around the United States, some in Canada, one or two in the UK, one in Australia. You know, we just published this great book, which the feedback's been really great so far. Really excited about that. It hit number one. It's the number one best-selling book on all of Amazon, all of Barnes & Noble, which we're pretty excited about. We're just getting started. So that's the nutshell version of the story of how we got to today. And there's a lot of great stories in there as well.
Yeah, I mean, that's a pretty rich background. I mean, how old are you now?
I'm 32.
32. So, I mean, you're only about 4 years older than me, but quite a bit further along that path than I am.
It's funny, you say that, because I look at some guys that I feel like I lost a lot of time coming out of school, not going into business for myself right away. I've got some buddies that are the same age as me, and these are guys that they never had a job, right? So they started a business in college, you know, got some traction. And when they graduated, they just kept running that business. And so they've been in business, gosh, now since, 14 years. And so, for them, it's like, you know, they've been doing this eons longer, and they're the same age. So I think it's all relative, man. I mean, I think it's all, you can't really compare yourself or, you know, to where someone else is. We all get started at different times. And there's a great infographic. I don't know if you've seen it. It's about people who have started businesses later in life right? And it's like you've seen people, and you know, Colonel Sanders is like the famous one because he, you know, started, you know, the KFC business when he was in his 60s or 70s. But there's so many really famous entrepreneurs who got their start in their business much later in life, in their 30s, 40s, and 50s. So, you know, the key message is like, it's never too late. I felt like it was too late when I was starting. I felt like, I mean, as crazy as it sounds, I was like in my mid 20s, I'm like, man, I'm like, that's it. Like, I've missed my window. You know, I think we all kind of feel that way.
No, I think it's easy to fall into that trap. But I mean, the window can always be there. It's just a matter of how much planning and runway you want to build for yourself as far as money and how much, you know, you really, really want it to put that effort and time in, and how much you're willing to say, okay, I'm going to jump away from my job.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
So when you left China, you came back to America to start your own venture?
Well, this is the story. It's so I kind of had this midlife crisis, quarter life crisis, mid 20s. And I think it was in 2007, I started becoming really like, all right, what am I going to do? Like, I don't want to do this. And I took a trip with my wife in Asia. We took I needed a break. I was basically burnt out. And you have to understand where we were. So we were doing this kind of crazy bi-country marriage. I was living in Shanghai, China, which is where I was based. I was where our China headquarters were. But my wife was getting a PhD at Hong Kong University. And so we're living this crazy bi-country marriage where I would fly to see her every 2 weeks, and she'd come up to Shanghai occasionally. We'd see each other like a couple times a month. And I was flying all over the country, basically living out of hotels, going to city after city after city, opening up these sales offices around China. And we take a trip to Malaysia, Kota Kinabalu, Shangri-La in Borneo. It's absolutely beautiful. And my wife flies up to Shanghai, and we fly from Shanghai to KK, Kota Kinabalu, this crazy bi-country marriage. And we decide we're going to take this trip just to kind of like decompress. And I'm one of these people that every time I take a trip, I always have to have something to listen to, like podcasts weren't super big back in 2007, but something to listen to. And at the time it was like audiobooks. And so my wife is like, literally like, Ryan, we got to go. The cab's outside. We got to go. I'm like, honey, I need something to listen to. Like, I can't do this. And I rush to Audible and I download a book. I'm like, what am I going to download? And I'm like, all right, this one looks kind of interesting. And the book was 4-Hour Work Week. And at the time in China, like, I'm totally, you have to understand, totally isolated. This is a brand new book. This isn't the like the book that everybody knows today. It's like, you know, interesting new reads. Oh, check this out. Like, just launched. Like, the book just came out. And I'm like, all right, I'll check this thing out. Cool title. And I'm listening to it in the airport. I remember having my, I think it was like an iPod, whatever, the one with the wheel on it back in the, I had that and I'm listening to it, and I couldn't take the headphones out of my ears on that trip. Like, we're at the beach, we're at the pool, we're like going snorkeling. I'm like, honey, no, I have to listen to this. It like completely mesmerized me. I'm like, there's this whole other world out there that I don't even know. So that kind of kicked me off on this path to basically do something I was like totally against who I was. And I started buying all these like how to make money on the internet courses, and I was having them like shipped to China, and they'd arrive in these like beat up boxes, and so anyways, I most of them were just BS. They're a bunch of, you know, kind of scammy type things. But then there was one that really resonated with me, and it was a course by Dr. Glenn Livingston. Glenn went on to become probably one of my most important mentors, my most cherished mentor. He wrote the foreword to our book, and he had this methodology where he had entered into all these tiny little niche markets like guinea pig care and pygmy goat care and all these little things. And none of them made a lot of money. They all made like a couple thousand dollars a month. But altogether, he was making like $30,000 a month. And for me at the time, that was like, what can you do with that kind of money? Like, that's more money than I would ever want. And the fact that you can make that money from home, it was just so inspiring. So I went down that path, and eventually I tried a few things, put it aside, and couldn't make it work. And then one day, my wife, who's in Hong Kong, reaches out to me and she said, "Hey, Ryan, I know you're looking for a market to go into, and hear me out on this one." Again, this was like a new site at the time that was nobody knew about. She said, "There's this new site out there. It's like eBay, but for handmade goods, and it's called Etsy.com." And she's like, "What's really cool about the site is that on people's profiles, you can see how many sales they're generating every single day." And she's like, "Check this out." She's like, "Look at these people. There are these people that are selling this type of jewelry that makes that it combines Scrabble tiles, like the game Scrabble tiles and origami paper and a few other kind of things. And look at it, it's like really cool. And look at how much these people are selling. They're selling like $1,000 a day of this jewelry. And she's like, I think this could be it. Like, let's do this. Like, we're here in China. We have access to the best library of origami paper, better than anywhere, right? We're in Asia. Everyone else is in the US. They're getting stuff like, imported. We have it right here. We have access to inexpensive labor, so we can get people to make this jewelry for us really inexpensively. Like, we could do this. And then, originally I was like, our plan, and I was like, well, time out a second. Like, that's crazy. You know, one of the reasons why we wanted to go into business is I don't want to be traveling. I don't want to be having to go to a factory in southern China. I don't want to have to be sourcing product from Japan or Korea or wherever to get this origami paper. I want to be able to just like, I want us, honey, you and me, to never have to be apart. Like, I want us to be together. I want us to be able to travel, location independent business. And so we kind of hit the brakes on that. And then a couple of days later, she came back and she says, you're going to kill me, but again, hear me out. It's a Scrabble tile thing, but check out what these guys are doing. And I looked at it and she said, look, they're not selling the jewelry. They're selling a digital tutorial on how to make the jewelry. And check this out. They're not making $1,000 a day, but they're making like $500 a day. And it's all profit. And we're like, holy crap. And I had that moment where it was like, the 1849 gold rush, right? Who made all the money in the gold rush? The guys selling picks and shovels. And I just had this epiphany. I'm like, this is a picks and shovels moment. And so we buy the competitor product and a couple of them, and they were all garbage. And we're like, we can build a better mousetrap. Like, we can do better than this. And so, I'm still working my job. I was at AIG. She's doing her PhD program at HKU, Hong Kong University. And we're doing this nights and weekends. And we're putting this stuff together. We build a little website. We build an Etsy shop. We create the product. We launch it. And then it's like crickets, nothing. I'm like, all right, what are we going to do? And then we start hustling. We start, going into these forums and like doing these super discount deals just to get a little momentum, just to get a little feedback, to get some, five-star reviews and people to actually experience the product. So we're selling at a super discount. We're doing like, 10 copies for a dollar, 10 for a dollar, get it now. We're getting like a little bit of momentum. And eventually we start selling a little bit. We're selling, a couple hundred dollars a month. We get maybe close to $1,000 a month, but we hit this wall. And basically out of desperation, I reached out to the people who are on our list who hadn't yet bought. And I'm like, why haven't you bought? Like, I literally reached out to them and sent a survey out and said, why have you not purchased? I'm like, we've got all these 5-star reviews and we have the best, in our opinion, the best product in the market. We put our heart and soul into this. Why haven't you bought? And that was like the thing that started off the entire ask formula, which is taught in the book. It's what started off the 23 markets that we successfully entered, $100 million in online revenue that we've generated since then. And it all started with this. We asked people, why didn't you buy? And the epiphany was that what we thought was one market, people who wanted to make Scrabble tile jewelry, it turns out it was actually 4 different groups of people, 4 buckets, 4 sub-markets. And one sub-bucket was people who wanted to make the Scrabble tile jewelry, but there were also people who wanted to make photo jewelry, custom photo jewelry. And there are people who wanted to make glass tile jewelry. So similar approach, but they wanted to use glass tiles instead of Scrabble tiles. And then there was a 4th group of people that had all the supplies. And their question was, wait, I got all this stuff lying around in my house. What other crafts can I make with these Scrabble tiles and origami paper and the glazes and all the different chemicals that you need to make the product? And so we went back to the drawing board. We said, what we need to do, instead of selling one thing, we need to sell 4 things. And we created 4 different products. We created 4 different, we didn't call it sales funnels at the time, but 4 different sales funnels to guide people into the most appropriate direction. And that was the thing that took things off. Instantly, overnight, we became the #1 best-selling purveyor of these courses. We took the business to its peak at just about $10,000 a month. And we thought all was good. Now, the interesting thing is it sounds like, all right, this is great, like happy ending, all is well. Well, in the middle of all this, in my job, I was at the struggle where I thought, you know, when am I going to make the leap, right? Which I know is probably a question for a lot of people who might be listening to this is, all right, well, when do you make the leap? Well, we were at a point where we were only making, you know, a few thousand dollars gross on the side. And this is in 2008 now. And in 2008, I don't know if you remember this, but that's when the world financial crisis hit. And so companies like Bear Stearns, companies like Lehman Brothers just went out of business overnight. And there's one day where I walked from my apartment in Shanghai to our office, went into my office, and I picked up the newspaper sitting on my desk, and the headline read, AIG to file for bankruptcy. When I got that paper, I picked up the phone that day and I said, honey, I think this is the day. Like, I think this is, you know, this is a sign that now's the time. And I drafted up a resignation letter, dropped it off on my boss's desk, handed it to him, and I said, this is my 2 weeks' notice. I'm going to be leaving. It was one of the hardest things that I did, but that the fact that, and I'm so, the company ended up surviving, the U.S. government bailed out AIG, but, and I'm happy that my colleagues and everyone ended up being in a good position, but it was one of those things where it was tragedy, you know, ended up being like the thing, the kick in the butt to say, all right, now or never. And then sold everything that I owned except for two suitcases worth of stuff, moved in with my wife in Hong Kong in student accommodations, a 400 square foot apartment, super tiny. And all I had was my $450 laptop, internet connection. And we took that Scrabble tile business, like I mentioned, to $10,000 a month. And, you know, we thought we were going to build this massive jewelry empire, which was going to be our multi-million dollar business. Unfortunately, it didn't quite work out that way.
You know, it's funny you mention that because I was just talking to my dad the other day, and he's like, geez, man, there seems to be more money in teaching people how to do things than there is actually doing the thing to make the money in the first place. And I was like, well, that would be true, I guess, because there's a lot more people out there that want to learn versus how many people are willing to buy it and how many times they're going to buy. You know, if you were selling the jewelry, how many pieces of jewelry am I going to buy from you if it's Scrabble tile?
Right.
One,
right.
Maybe two. And it's funny that the whole story revolves around Etsy because, you know, me and my wife makes handmade greeting cards, birthday cards, wedding invitations, all that stuff. And she had like asked a couple years ago, she's like, oh, I want to start an Etsy store. I was like, okay, well, that's going to eat up a lot of time. I was like, oh, wow, just like you did. Etsy shows you how many that they're, you know, how many sales have they made. So then I started running the numbers on a lot of these accounts and I'm like, not a whole lot of these people are making enough money where you could like quit your job and just make jewelry or cards or whatever, right?
Right.
I was like, so that's when it would be a few years before we were like, hey, what if we set up an online account where people could get a birthday card every single month for like $4? And that leads into custom orders, opens up a lot of doors and gets people, you know, interested. So it's really interesting how Etsy, even though I didn't wind up going with Etsy for our store because I have the web development background to just make it up myself, how it all funnels, there's that word again, back into each other.
Totally. I mean, it's Etsy was a great place for us to start, and the lesson there is if you're just getting started, there's a tendency, I think, and I just as guilty of this as anybody. I think there's a tendency to think that the secret is finding something that nobody else has thought about, right? It's like, oh, I've got this brilliant idea and nobody is doing it. Chances are if nobody's doing it, I'm sorry. There are, what, 7+ billion people in the world? Chances are, sorry, you're not the first person with the idea. And if someone has not successfully proven that business model online, well, you've got a long road ahead of you. There's a reason why the saying, pioneers get shot and settlers get rich, is true. And so what you really want to do, the lesson there is find something that's already proven. It's much more successful to be Google than it is, which everybody knows, than to be excite.com or ask.com or altavista.com. They're done. They're the pioneers. Google's a settler. They built a better mousetrap. Right? Facebook, same thing. They didn't invent this concept. They built, Zuckerberg and the company built a better mousetrap, and that's why they are what they are. Nobody, I mean, MySpace is a ghost town. MySpace is, you know, it isn't what it is. And there's precursors to MySpace. There's that
Friendster.
I can't remember the name of it. What is it?
Friendster.
Friendster's one, and then there's one that was even before that. God, in college we had this one that was called the Daily Jolt, which I don't even know if that exists anymore. But that was like a precursor to all of these. There's another one that I can't think of the name of it. But the point is, so that's the big lesson there. Now there's another lesson this, which is, so Ryan, is did you, you know, move in, generate all this money and go on to build riches? Well, no. See, what happened was this. So the Scrabble tile jewelry thing, if you go on Etsy today, you ain't going to see the same story as you saw in 2008. What we found out, I quit my job, move in with my wife. She's doing her PhD program. I'm doing the business full time. We're not making a lot of money. She gets a $500 a month stipend, and that's basically what we're living on. Every dime that we make in the business, we're pouring it back in, putting it into advertising spend. We're using it to buy information products, to, you know, to learn things. I'm spending money on software, you know, building different websites. I'm just putting everything back into the business. And just a couple months after I quit my job, just like the world financial crisis and the world financial markets crashed, the Scrabble tile jewelry market crashed overnight. Turns out it was just a fad. It was like Beanie Babies or Pogs, like all these stories that you hear where it's like the market crescendos and all of a sudden it's like, boom, prices hit a floor. The jewelry that was once selling for 20, 30, 40, 50 bucks for one of these pieces was like down to like $4.95. And when that happened, nobody wanted to make the jewelry anymore because there's no profit in it. There's no opportunity to make money. The market had become saturated. People stopped buying the courses. People started putting a bunch of stuff for free online, which happens. And then we looked at each other and it was like one of those like, oh crap moments where it's like, okay, what are we going to do now? My wife's bringing in $500 a month in her PhD stipend. The business is bringing in like nothing. And we said, what are we going to do? And basically, my wife said, okay, here's what we can do. I'll finish my program. We'll wrap it up and I'll get a job. And her background is in museum studies and history. And so the museum study world, I'm sorry, if anybody's on this call and you're in that world, does that world make a lot of money? The answer is no. But she managed to get an amazing job as a museum curator back in Brownsville, Texas. And the job paid $36,000 a year. And I was like, you know, all right.
It's more than zero.
What's that?
It's more than zero.
It's more than zero, but not much more than zero. So once again, in Hong Kong now, we sold everything that we owned in Hong Kong. Now, she had her two suitcases. I had my two suitcases. And we moved back to Brownsville. And we find the cheapest apartment that we can find that didn't have bars on the windows. It was like $500 a month. We didn't have any furniture, nothing. We started from scratch. So I tell this story. We opened up a business bank account, and the prize for opening up the bank account, like the you know, like, hey, open up a bank account and get this cool thing, was a collapsible lawn chair, like the ones that you see on the side of soccer games. And my wife is like a pretty good negotiator, so she like finagled two out of them. That became our living room furniture, no joke. So we had two of those lawn chairs in our living room. We got a TV for $5 from the Goodwill. No cable. We had the rabbit ears that we jammed into the windowsill to like extend the reception. We had $50 a week, shopped at Walmart for groceries. We had date night at Stars Drive-In, which is like a real ghetto fast food restaurant down in the Rio Grande Valley in South Texas, which is where Brownsville is. And they had Thursday nights. And this place was cheap to begin with, but we only went there on Thursday nights when they had $1 hamburgers. And we'd get three burgers and we'd split them, and that was like our dinner. So date night was like a $3 experience plus tax. We wouldn't buy any drinks or anything like that. We'd just bring water. And that was our life. And I did that. And basically I'd drive my wife one car to and from work, had a mattress on the floor, no furniture, drive her to work. I'd work during the day on our next business. And she would come home at night and we'd spend the night basically packing up whatever we sold. In, you know, the books and CDs and DVDs that we're selling, we'd pack them up, put labels on them. We'd put, you know, have this operation on the floor. We'd watch whatever one channel we got on television, and we'd pass out and then just start the thing all over again. And, this next business that I went into, I learned my mistake. I said, I'm never going to go into a fad market ever again. But I took a lot of lessons from that first Etsy business. We went into, arguably the longest lasting, hobby market, the largest hobby in the United States. Do you know what it is?
Would it be that crocheting thing?
It's gardening. Gardening is the number one hobby, and gardening including caring for house plants and courtyard gardening.
I call that
and,
work. And, I don't call that a hobby.
I'm with you. But it's the number one hobby in America. And I said, I don't want to go into a market that has this fad risk. I want to go into what's an evergreen market, a market that's going to be there in 5 years, 10 years, 20 years. So we went into the gardening market. And I got to work, and long story short, took that business from nothing to $25,000 a month in 18 months. My wife, at that point, we felt confident she could quit her job. We bought a house in Austin, Texas, moved up, drove 500 miles from Brownsville, Texas to Austin, Texas, bought our house, moved here, launched our third market, this time in the memory improvement space, which is a business that many people know. It's probably my best known niche business. It's called Rocket Memory. I talk a lot about it in the book. That became our most successful niche business. And then businesses started approaching me and saying, hey, Ryan, how are you doing this? What's your approach? How are you going into markets and having this level of success? When I started talking about this in masterminds, one business approached me and said, hey, Ryan, would you ever consider doing this for another company and just us paying you a big pile of money and percentage of the profits? Would you be open to doing this? And I wasn't something I considered at the time, but I decided to give it a shot. And we had a ton of success with it. And that spawned the progression of going into market after market after market using what's now become this ask formula, which is in the book. And, you know, we're in 23 different markets ranging from weight loss supplements, high-level water filtration systems, dentistry, dog training, tennis instruction, golf instruction, satellite TV, business funding, the survival market, and the list goes on and on and on. And now we have an agency, we have a course, we have a book, we have high-level masterminds and coaching programs. We teach people, business owners, how to go through this process. And so, but it all started in those early days where, you know, I came from nothing growing up. We lived with nothing when we made the leap. And I think that's the big takeaway there is I think a lot of people, they and I've gotten a little bit of this comments, they see the book launch hitting number one. They say, oh, I could never do that because I don't have, you know, I wasn't born with all these connections or I wasn't born with all this. And you know, we built this from nothing, you know, just blood, sweat, and tears to make this happen. The key takeaway is when you're studying someone, and I try to do this myself, there's a mistake I think that people make, which is whoever your hero is in business and life, you know, pick anybody, whether it's, you know, like Mark Cuban, for example, is someone that a lot of people look up to as an entrepreneur. You look at Mark Cuban, the mistake is to look at the way Mark Cuban behaves today as a billionaire. The real answer is to look at where was he before he had any success and what did he do? The dude freaking lived in his car and didn't take a vacation for 7 years. That's what you want to pay attention to. So if you aspire to that level of success, pay attention not to the way that person behaves now when they've achieved that success, but the path they took to get there. And that's why I'm so transparent about our story, that we had nothing. We didn't have any money. We started, you know, making very little money. I kept our expenses extremely lean, put every penny that we earned back into the business, made a lot of sacrifices, ate frozen pizza and crappy food from Walmart just to keep our living expenses as low as possible. No movies, no new clothes, no fancy furniture. I mean, no furniture at all. Basic car. I mean, we just did that to get us through that period. And then now, you know, what's the payoff? Well, the payoff's amazing. You know, we have a location independent business, 25 people on our team. You know, we'll do about 5 million this year. We've got, I don't do any work as you brought up. You know, we've got a cook, we've got housekeeper, we've got handyman, you know, all the things that I hate doing. None of that's done. We don't want for anything. We can, you know, pretty much anything that we want, we're able to purchase. We can take, you know, we can travel wherever we want, location independent business, send our children to private school. You know, that's the payoff. But it's, you know, to get there is a process. And for me, I mean, there's smarter people on this call than I am. And for me, it took, you know, it almost took 10 years to get from there to where we are today. And there, I'm sure there are people that can shortcut that process, but that's the truth. Like, that's the honest truth. And you just have to ask yourself, how bad do you want it? And if you want it, the path that you know, that we've laid out in the book, it's all there, right? The book just walks you through exactly how to do it. And if you have that roadmap, all you have to do is follow it, right? It's like climbing Everest, right? Climbing Everest is going to be work. But if you have a roadmap and a guide to take you to the summit, you know you're going to get there. You just got to keep putting one foot in front of the other. And I think that's the key message.
Yeah, I think it's all about paying the, it all costs money, right? And money isn't necessarily in the dollar sense. It's in the time and the effort sense and the sacrifice sense, you know, how much you're willing to sacrifice, how much you're willing to time you're willing. How many days in a row can you work, you know, 15 to 20 hours where like you're literally that's all you're doing except to maybe stop and eat.
Right. I mean, it's that singular focus. And then the other thing that I always remember, I love saying this to people is money buys speed. Money buys speed. So, for example, if you work privately with someone like myself, well, you just bought yourself, you know, you've saved yourself, you shaved 6, 7, 8 years off that process, right? You go off it on your own, then you're going to take that full time. Now, and there's variations on that. So you might not be able to work privately with someone who's achieved that because it's just cost prohibitive for you. You can't afford that. But you work, you know, in a mastermind setting, or you join a community of people who have been there, and you around and surrounding yourself with these people. So to the extent that you can buy time with money, that gets you to that goal so much faster. And at the end of the day, time is the only thing that we can't replenish, right? I've had ups and downs money-wise. I mean, I walked away from a ton of money from my job at AIG, a lot of long-term compensation, stock options that had invested. That was painful. I had to walk away from a ton of money that was just there in a bank account that just disappeared the moment that I left, because I would have had to stick around for a period of years in order for that money to actually become real. So when I walked away, I mean, that was painful. It's like you see that money, it's no longer there. But I knew that if I just waited another 5 years and stuck it out to have more money, that it might be too late. Like I might never make the leap. And I did not want that to happen. So
yeah, you could have been hit by a bus, walking home. You never
and I wrote
know.
That in the book. I share this pretty personal and embarrassing letter. It's the longest letter I've probably ever written. I addressed it to my mom, but it was really a letter to myself to clarify kind of my own thinking. And it was super embarrassing, deeply personal. And I mentioned it offhand to my publisher. And he said, Ryan, let me see this letter. I was like, ugh. I'm like, I don't even know if I have it. It's like on my heart. You know, it's like an email I sent. I sent it to my mom. It was like 2008. I'm like, I don't even know if I have it. I dug it up, sent it to him. I'm like, you have to keep this private. Literally, the only two human beings who have ever seen this are me and my mom. That's it. It's super embarrassing, super personal. And he read it and he writes me back and he says, this has to make it in the book. This is something that every struggling entrepreneur needs to read to know what you are going through. Every college graduate needs to read this to know what it really takes. And so I shared that letter. And in the letter, to your point about getting hit by the bus, that was one of the things I said. I said, Mom, it just occurred to me the other day that I might, like, I could die tomorrow and I would live with so much regret if I did not do this now. And I said, even if I fail, I'm okay with that. Like, I'm okay with failing. And that was like a key thing. It was like no longer being afraid of failure. And nobody, you shouldn't be afraid to fail. And you shouldn't, I'm gonna pontificate this on just a moment, but you shouldn't instill in your kids that they should be afraid to fail. That is so hard. We're taught growing up in school that getting an F, failing, is bad. And it's so deep in our DNA that if you fail, that if you don't achieve the right result, that it's failure. And so what does that lead us to do? It leads us to inaction. We become afraid to even freaking try. And that, I get really passionate about this because at the end of the day, it's all about trying. Entrepreneurship, business is all about experiments. It's trying something. It's not going to work. What do you learn from that? Okay, let's course correct. Let's try another experiment. And so I think that's one of the things that held me back for the longest time was this fear of failure. Like, what if I lose it all? And to be honest, go in that time in Brownsville. To go in that time in Brownsville, Joe, when we were living on the $500, my wife's $36,000 a year salary, that was key because it was fine. Like as sucky as that might sound to like live with none of those things, like we were fine. Like I have so many fond memories of those days. And for me, going through that was so key that I knew, okay, I don't need to live with the car and driver that we had in Shanghai. I don't need to live with the housekeeper. We don't need the fancy apartment. I'm no more happy with those things than without them. It's all about what, you know, your approach, your attitude. And I think when you go through that, if you have an opportunity to go through that period of quote unquote financial struggle, I think that's one of the biggest blessings that you can have. So for anybody who might be there now and you're saying, I've got no money, I don't have any money in the bank, I'm $100,000 in debt, whatever, that builds character. That builds you into who you are and will build you into the successful entrepreneur that you either are now or that you'll grow into becoming.
You know, you touched on something with having all those things, a driver and things that most people do not have.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of times with that kind of money and that responsibility that comes with it, with having that level of a job, it goes to say like, well, it helps justify me doing what I do, even though doing what you do wasn't really making you happy. It was just like a pacifier to be like, well, hey, at least I have these things and I should be thankful for these things. And you should. But at the same time, if you're not happy inside, then it doesn't really make a difference. With your mom, I was curious, what did your parents think about that when you left AIG?
They didn't believe in me. The only person in the world that believed in me was my wife. It was one of the hardest things. They thought I was an idiot. You have to understand the fall from grace. It's like, come from nothing, go to Ivy League, going to become a world-class neuroscientist. My best friend at Brown, who's my roommate, he is a neurologist today at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. He went all the way. He's at the top of his profession. That's, in my parents' view, that's where I should be. I should be a neurosurgeon at the Mayo Clinic. Like, that is my buddy Charles, and I talk about Charles in the book. That's where he's at right now. At Brown, I realized there's a difference between smart and really freaking smart. I was smart. Charles is really smart. And to fall from, okay, being the next great neuroscientist to, well, okay, well, our son's going to work on Wall Street. That's not bad. To, well, I'm not going to work on Wall Street. I'm going to go work in China. Okay, that's okay. To having this great job to, all right, Ma, I'm not going to do this anymore, but instead, I'm going to teach people how to make jewelry using Scrabble tiles and origami paper, and I'm going to sell ebooks. And that's what my Ivy League education is doing. You cool with that? They were so disappointed. So disappointed. That was really hard. And in fact, nobody believed in me. Everyone thought, what the hell are you doing? You're stupid. You know, my wife believed in me because she knew. She knew that we could make this what it's become. And it's taken till today. And even today, I have people that are just like, what are you doing, right? And they see the articles coming out. They see the best-selling book. And still, it's like, you know, what are you doing? So I think, you know, to answer your question, that's hard. And as an entrepreneur, I just want to say this right now. People who love you, and that's going to happen. And part of it is people don't understand. People don't understand what we go through, that drive about like, we're okay with that. And then there's other people that even when they don't intend this to happen, this is just a facet of human nature, is that we actually want other people to fail so we can feel better about ourselves, right? In German, it's Schadenfreude or whatever. It's an actual phenomenon. We can't even control it. And so even when people have your best interests at heart, and the thing that bugs me the most, and you're going to see this too, anybody listen to this, and I imagine most of us can identify with this, you're going to get advice from people who are going to tell you what you can't do, and these are people who have not done it. Don't take advice from those people. Take advice from the people who have done it. Look to those people, right? There are people who are going to say, oh, I don't know if you can do that, and they've never achieved whatever it is that you're looking to achieve. Just find someone out there who's done it and take the advice from that person, right? And so, you know, in my very modest level of success, the people in our world, they see that and they say, all right, he's done it. I know the path to follow. I just follow that same path and I can do it. Ryan ain't any smarter than I am. He's not going to work any harder than I am. And you just follow that path. That's the way I found my mentors, as I found Glenn and I found other people. And I said, all right, if he can do it, I can do it. I just have to walk those same steps. And so the well-meaning people in your life, whether it's your parents, your siblings, maybe your spouse or your partner, you know, your friends that you've had for years, your childhood friends who have known you since you were 10 years old. At some point, these people are going to come and say, you know, dude, I don't know if that's a good idea. And you're going to have to be strong. You're going to have to be strong and stick to your convictions. And I'm telling you right now, if you feel it, if you feel that fire in your belly and you feel that conviction, you go with it. Because nobody's going to believe in you as much as you believe in yourself. And it all starts with that.
You know, one of the two things I always talk about is how much you need a partner to believe in you, whether it's your wife or whatever, just somebody that does believe in you. So that one, it validates that you're not crazy or completely, you know, off the wall. Right. And two, somebody's there to pick you up when your family doesn't believe in you. And I've had a lot of doubt in my family for what I've been building for a year now. So I completely understand where you're coming from. And I also understand, you know, having all that money and then all of a sudden you step off the mountain. And when you're at the mountain, you're like, oh man, it's not, you know, it doesn't look that bad down, you know, down there. But when you step off and you turn around, you're like, man, that was a pretty high mountain I was standing on. Didn't realize it when I was on it. But you know, you just have to own your own vision, and that's something that, you know, I wrote about a whole chapter in my book is owning your own vision so much that you become so brave and convicted in it that you're not afraid to tell other people because you're not afraid of what they may or may not say to you or behind your back.
Right. What's the Gandhi quote? I mean, I don't know it verbatim, but it's I'm looking it up right now. It's I'm gonna revise it. Let me see if I can find it. See if I can find it right now. First, they ignore you. Then they laugh at you. Then they fight you. Then you win. So true.
Yeah, definitely. So, Ryan, what's been the biggest roadblock you've hit in your entrepreneurial career?
Gosh, there have been a couple. For a while, it was reaching a certain level of complacency. And so I'll explain what I mean by that. So after we launched the first couple businesses, we'd reached a point where I was making more money every month than, you know, we were spending. I know we're not doing this on camera. You know, people know this about me. I'm not a very spendy person. I have two things that I wear, my workout shirt. I've got like 10 of these, and I have a golf shirt that I buy from Target for $14.95 full price. Usually it's given to me as a gift on sale for like $7.95 or $9.95. That's what I wear. That's like my wardrobe. I'm not wearing Gucci. I'm not wearing Prada. I don't have expensive taste. The shoes that I have right here, these are New Balance shoes, if you can see them. I've got like 5 pairs of these in my closet right now because I love them. When they wear out, I wear the next one. So that's the type of person that I am. I don't have these huge material obsessions around things. So to be, and I'm fortunate to be married to someone who doesn't either. So I don't have this huge, like, all right, I want to buy a yacht or, you know, I want to buy a 10,000 square foot mansion aspirations. I don't have something that's driving me like that. So it's what motivates you. And for me, Joe, the thing that happened, I talk about this in the book, this is why I published the book in full disclosure, is so 3 years ago, coming on the third year anniversary, I got very, very sick. It was a few months after our first son was born. You can see me on camera. I'm not a big guy. I'm right now, I'm probably about 170 pounds. My peak, I'm like 180 if I'm really lifting heavy weight and bulking up. And I dropped from about 165, 168 to 130 pounds. And we didn't know what was wrong. And I was tired all the time and I wasn't getting good sleep, thirsty all the time. And, my son was born and my wife encouraged me to apply for life insurance. She said, all right, you know, it's not just us anymore. We've got another life. You're the main breadwinner. You need to apply for life insurance. So I apply for life insurance at her urging and the medical examiner comes to the house, does their thing. Like 2 days later, I have to go off to a trip. I go to a trip to New York City, ClickBank Exchange, a conference in the industry. I was at the Marriott Marquis in Times Square. Go to the conference, come back home, have a bunch of mail piled up. Top of the mail is the letter from the life insurance company. Open it up, and the letter reads, denied. I'm like, what? You know, 30 years old. I'm like, what is this? So I reach out to the life insurance agent. I'm like, all right, I think there's some mistake. Like, you know, letters must have been crossed, something like that. And life insurance agent, he says, Ryan, actually, it isn't a mistake. And not only do I have your letter, I also have your lab results in front of me, and I'm going to send these to you. And he says, I'm not a doctor, but your lab results are off the charts. And he says, I think, let me give you some numbers. I think you need to sit down. He gives me the numbers. I look, start, and I, you know, record them. He's like, I'll send this over to you. And I make the mistake, Joe. I go to Google and I start like typing in the numbers into Google. And I'm basically, I had like the almost like a panic attack because the numbers are renal system shutdown, kidney failure, pancreatic failure. And I'm like, crap, what have I done? And then it's starting to come together, like this lack of weight, the loss of weight, this fatigue, like maybe this is all connected. So, and I didn't tell my wife right away. And so later that night, we put our son to bed. He was about 6 or 7 months old at the time, put him to bed. And my wife kind of casually says, like, all right, life insurance is all taken care of, all good. And I was like, well, we need to talk. And so we sit down and show her the numbers and she just loses it. She's crying. Then she's mad at me because she knows I pushed the envelope and she's like, what have you done? What have you done to your body? You pushed it too far. You did too much. And she's panicking. And so she calls the Ask a Nurse hotline, schedules a doctor's appointment for the next day, go to the doctors. And I don't go to the doctors. Like I don't do like an annual checkup. I know I should. Up until the time I never did that. I do now. And so I go to the doctor. He's never seen me before. He's like, all right, well, we'll get some lab results done. Check it out. He's like, we'll do it stat. Stay here in the waiting room and I'll be out in a few minutes, you know, with the results. It's like 20, 30 minutes. Comes out and he comes out and his demeanor is totally different. Like he comes out and he grabs me by the shoulders and he looks me in the eye and very slowly says, Ryan, you should be in a coma right now. You need to go to the emergency room right now and you're not driving. Your wife needs to take you right away. And so my wife takes me to the emergency room. And it turns out I'm in this state known as DKA, diabetic ketoacidosis. The reason why I lost all this weight is because my body stopped the ability to metabolize food. I wasn't able to actually metabolize food. So I was eating muscle tissue. I had blood in my urine. My organs were shutting down. My pancreas effectively stopped working. And I spent over a week in the ICU, basically on life support, pumping medication and fluids and just bringing me back. You know, 10 days in the ICU and away from my newborn son and wife, just had to be isolated. I couldn't see my son. They couldn't, like, it was just too risky. There's someone on dialysis next to me, someone in terminal cancer. You know, it's like you go to ICU, basically, that's where people go to die. And I'm like this young guy. It's like, what the hell? And so turns out, 30 years old, I find out I had become a juvenile diabetic, a type 1 diabetic. And the way most people find out about this in DKA is they do slip into a coma as an adult. It's extremely rare. I'm not the first person ever to get to become a type 1 diabetic at that age, but it's extremely rare. And so, I did a lot of damage to my body. And I came out of the hospital not with the same life expectancy that I had, you know, going in, like what I thought. And so, you know, when you come to terms with your own mortality like that, it really forces you to decide, well, what the hell are you going to do with your life? And for me, that was the tragedy that spawned everything. That's the reason why I decided to write the book. It's the reason why I said, I can't keep this formula, what's effectively my secret family recipe. I just can't keep this to myself. It's made us a ton of money. It's made my small group of private clients a ton of money as well. I need the world needs to see this because this is something that can revolutionize the way that business is conducted online, revolutionize so many people's lives. And I said, I'm just going to give it all away. I'm going to give it away in this book, put it all out there. And ever since coming out of that hospital, Joe, I've been like a bullet out of the gun and just haven't stopped. I found another gear that I didn't even know I have. And just we've been on a tear, on a mission to get this approach in as many businesses' hands as possible. And so when you ask the question, what's been the biggest challenge? Up until that point, it was complacency because it's sort of like you reach a certain level. It's like, what next? Why? What motivates you? Well, this is the thing that motivates me is that, you know, a client of mine said, he said, I finally get, Ryan, why you operate at the pace and speed that you operate. It's that you're afraid to die. And you don't know what you're going to be able to get done before that happens. And so that's where I'm at right now, is I want to make as much of an impact as possible. That's the thing that keeps me going. That's the thing that gets me excited. That's why we're talking today. That's why this book is out. And that's why we're pushing it as far as we can push it.
You know, I feel like we're, you know, cut from a very similar cloth there, man. It's it very much the same way, working on so many projects and trying to turn them out as quickly as I can. Some people I'd ask my wife while I wasn't around, like, how fast did Joe write this book? And she was like, 2 months. And they were like, 2 months? Like,
that's insane.
I mean, the book was short.
I need to learn from you.
It's short. It's only 5,800 words. Ooh. But it's very intentional. It's for people who hate reading books, like myself. Mm-hmm. So, because I'm a slow reader. But yeah, I mean, I drew, it's like a picture book, so every picture is hand drawn by me, and that took forever to do. Like, it's Sharpie artwork, so it's like every coloring with Sharpies is, it's like a new form of torture. But I love the way it came out. But anyway, Ryan, what was your childhood dream growing up?
Childhood dream growing up, gosh, I think I, depending at what point in childhood you might have asked. There was a point, this is crazy, as funny as this is going to sound. I love this. I love the fact that you did your book in pictures. There was a point in my life where I thought I was going to become an artist. I was really into art growing up. I was I thought I was going to, at one point I even considered art school.
I'm not an artist, by the way.
Okay, all right.
That was the point. But, that was the point of drawing it, right? It was so that, it was to show the power of being yourself and what the power of not being an artist can accomplish.
That's awesome.
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, that's awesome. That's awesome. So my art now probably would look more like that because it's been years since I've really taken it seriously. But it was a time when I thought that was a path I was going to go on. But I was also really interested in the brain and psychology and really, you know, the science and the body. And I found this really weird, this is going to sound so bizarre, really weird thing that I became obsessed with, which was like my dream. I had this dream that I was going to design prosthetic limbs. As crazy as that sounds, that's the dead honest truth. At one point in my life, I thought I was going to become a prosthetic artist and basically sculpt and design prosthetic limbs and like, you know, I know that's like so bizarre to like even, you know, think like that. That was my dream. And that's what I told people. I was like, I'm going to design artificial limbs. And I would like draw arms and legs. I had notebooks full of this just for that purpose. So as weird as that may sound, that was my childhood dream at probably the age of, gosh, maybe 12 through 14.
Oh, wow. No, I think that's awesome, man. I think that's really neat. And if you think about the way that, you know, what you wanted to accomplish by doing the artificial limbs and working in artificial limbs, I mean, you went to medical school, right? And eventually you made it so that you can help a lot of people with their own businesses. And if you think about the correlation between drawing a prosthetic limb and how that would help somebody who needed that limb, you know, you're essentially still carrying out what your dream was, just in a different way that you never would have imagined. You know, that's the crazy one, right? The dream you actually lived is crazier than the idea of drawing limbs.
It's funny. And I think, I don't know, it's I'm making this connection right now, and I'm thinking as you're saying that what's interesting is at that age, I recognize that the value in doing and having a very specific focus, like a very niched down focus. And I think that's, if I can attribute the success that we have had to a few things, that's one of the things that's been a big part of our success is focusing on being, and this is advice I give to any, you know, coaching student, anyone in our world, is how can you be a category of one? So what space can you own? What piece of real estate can you squarely own in someone's mind? And when someone thinks of a survey funnel or the ask formula or selling using the exact approach that we use in our business, that's a very specific space that I own. And we are the best in the world at that tiny, 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 tiny little thing. And I think as an entrepreneur, there's a tendency to want to cast your net a little bit wider than is wise, because it's scary to think about narrowing your focus too much, because you say, well, then I'm saying no to all these different things. But in my experience, all the funnels that we've built, all the businesses that I've helped take from 6 to 7 figures, from 7 to 8 figures, taking our business from nothing to on a path to get to 8 figures, I've found that that's been one of the most important things, is to own a very specific piece of real estate in someone's mind, so that when they think about whatever it is, you are the clear and obvious choice. It's you, right? And so if you say, what's a great example? You know, if you think about, high-end electric car, it's Tesla, right? But if you're trying to be, affordable mid-size sedan, I mean, you could come up with an answer that'd be very different than what I might come up with and someone else, because there is no clear category of one. And so I think that's a big takeaway is at that young age, I don't know why, but I recognize the value in niching down, it was probably just dumb luck, but that's become like a big part of our marketing DNA in our business is that niching down piece. And so it's a big part of what we teach in the book. It's a big part of our success, and I'm a big advocate of taking that approach.
Ryan, moving forward, what do your dreams for the future look like?
Dream for the future is pretty simple. Our vision, as grand as this may sound, is so simple. And it's the reason why we wrote the book, the reason why I revealed my secret family recipe is because I truly believe that every homepage in the world will be modified to include a survey funnel. Full stop. Every homepage in the world should have a survey funnel. And that's the mission that we're on. That is the big ultimate dream for what we're doing in our business. That is like the end game, is to reach a point where we change or play a role in changing the face of online business. And the reason why I'm so passionate about it is because this is one of these things. And if you're not familiar with the survey funnel, if you don't know what that means, the book is and we're going to talk about a cool thing we're going to do, I think, in a minute here. But the book lays it all out. The reason why this is so exciting from my perspective is this concept is one of the rare things in business that simultaneously benefits business owners because it helps you more effectively market your products and services, but it also simultaneously benefits consumers as well. And it's rare to find something in business that is not manipulative, that doesn't, it's not a zero-sum game where it benefits business owners at the expense of consumers. This benefits both. And that's why I'm so passionate about it, why I'm so excited about it. And, in a nutshell, it's as simple as that. Every homepage in the world will have a survey funnel.
Well, Ryan, I would love for you to share how people can connect with you and get your book and everything like that.
Cool. Absolutely, my man. So I think we're going to do something cool, if I'm not mistaken. And if you'd like to check out a copy of the book, again, this became the number one best-selling book on Amazon, number one best-selling book on Barnes & Noble. And the title of the book is Ask. And there's a big, long subtitle to it, but it's basically the counterintuitive online formula. And I won't even go through the whole thing because you'll forget about it. Just know that the title of the book is Ask. And the URL, if you'd like to take advantage of this cool thing that we're going to do, which is we're going to give away 50 physical copies of the book. All that we ask is that you just cover the cost of shipping and handling, which is a very small token cost. Go to the website askformula.com, askformula.com, and then enter the coupon code DREAMER. And we've got 50 of those coupon codes, first come, first serve. If you are prompted to enter the coupon code, enter it. It'll take the cost of the book from full price down to nothing, and we just ask that you pay the small shipping and handling charge. And the book, check out the reviews on Amazon. The feedback's been overwhelmingly positive so far. People are saying that it's changing their lives, so I'm really excited to be able to make this available. And really, Joe, just a way of saying thanks for your support and thanks to everyone on this call. And it's been an awesome pleasure to be here and to share a little bit of our journey on how we got here.
Awesome, Ryan. I will have all that at howtodream.co for people to find and connect with you. I'll put in some other links as well, Twitter and Facebook as well. So I really appreciate you taking the time to come on today, and I'd love to have you on again in like a year to follow up and see how everything's been killing it for you.
I would be humbled and honored to do that, my man. So well, let's do it.
Thank you very much, Ryan.
Thanks, Joe. Take care. Have a great day.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Dreamers Podcast. Follow us on Twitter at Dreamers Podcast. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/Dreamers Podcast. If you or someone you know would like to be a guest on the Dreamers Podcast, please send an email to j@jpar.co. This podcast is copyright 2014 by jpar.co.